Chapter 2. He's gone.
And I found myself concerned with and anxious and worried about him dying early in my life. I was concerned about it. I used to ask him, please don't die, and I just wouldn't let it go. I knew that it was tragic. I knew I was worried. I was full of head anxiety about it.
I was always worried about my dad dying. Sometimes I'd see him and he was out of it. Sometimes I would find him passed out. I wrote a poem with the line, "I hope my daddy doesn't die." He had a TV and a chair set up in my room, so he would often come by and lounge in the chair and smoke his cigars. I could wake up at any time and he'd be sitting there. Once I was with a friend in my room, and when he came to my bedroom door, he started to fall. I could tell that he was moving too far to the right, starting to lean, and I yelled, "Go get him!" Me and my friend managed to get underneath him and hold him up until he grabbed hold of something and regained his composure, and then he just went back to his room. That happened a few times. Happy to see me, then the swaying. And it happened a lot toward the end. I was sitting next to him in my room watching TV, and I said, "Daddy, please don't go anywhere. Please don't die." He said, "I'm not going anywhere." Then he smiled at me. I knew that something tragic was coming, which made me feel protective that I had to watch out for him. One time I was walking by his bedroom and he was lying flat on his back. I saw how bloated his stomach was and it terrified me. A few days later, I was in my room with my friends. We were in the hamburger bed, all watching that sad movie Brian Song. About halfway through the film, I suddenly got really worried about my dad and went into his bathroom, where I found him face down. He'd used the towel rack to hold onto, but it had broken and he'd fallen. I ran downstairs and got Delta. She called for help, and they got him up, gave him coffee, and got him walking. I watched them walk him around the room. He was clinging onto them. At one point, his head was hanging down, but once he saw me in the chair, we locked eyes, and his whole face lit up. He tried to get away from them to come over to where I was, but I could tell he was going to be sick. I said, "No, he's going to throw up." So they took him to the bathroom, and sure enough, he got sick. I didn't say anything. I didn't talk to anyone about anything. I just internalized it all. One winter at Graceland, my dad wanted me to get on a snowmobile with him, but I was scared. He was wild, a wild card, a wild man. But I got on the snowmobile anyway because he was my dad. He started going down the steepest part of the driveway. He lost control and we started sliding and jumped the curb. We both stayed on somehow and landed on the grass laughing. But there was another time that he and some of his other guys went down on sleds on their bellies while the wives and kids were standing around watching them. I was at the top of the hill and I was worried to death because there was no way to stop those sleds, no brakes, no ropes to pull on. I just remember thinking, "What are you doing, Daddy?" I watched my dad go down on his stomach, and once again, like with the snowmobile, he jumped the curb at the bottom and rolled 3 times, and then he lay there, completely still. Everyone got worked up, started running toward him, scared that he was dead. As they approached, all freaking out, he flipped over on his back and let out a huge, guttural belly laugh like you wouldn't believe. He thought it was just the funniest thing. During the days, I ran around with a crowd that consisted of my cousins and friends. My grandfather had a girlfriend, Sandy Miller. She lived across the pasture in the house with him. She had 3 kids, 2 boys and 1 girl. The girl, Laura, was my age. She was one of my best friends. My cousin Patsy's daughter, Deanna Gamble, was also my best buddy. I was very protective of her, loved her a lot. But Laura and I would viciously fight each other. I would terrorize her, try to get her to eat my makeup. She and I were fighting in my room because I wanted her Barbie case and she wouldn't give it to me. "Give me that goddamn Barbie case," I said. "No, but I can't get it. Nowhere has it. You better give it to me," I said. There was a statue in my room and I picked it up over my head and Laura started screaming, "No!" Then her eyes darted to my right and I looked over to see my dad standing there. I quickly put the statue down and tried to act like we were just playing. What are you doing? He said. Nothing, just playing, I said. Don't kill your best friend, he said. Words of wisdom. When I was 8 or 9, I had a huge crush on one of Laura's brothers, Rory. I was head over heels, painfully in love with this boy for years. Rory was 5'11", dark hair, really cute. He had a great personality and these green eyes, amazing smile. I couldn't even move when he walked in the room. He would tell me he was going to write me letters and I'd wait and wait. I'd ask Laura to ask Rory if he liked me. I would hang on to anything that he said or did. I thought it was mutual because Rory kissed me maybe once, maybe twice when we were playing hide and seek in the dark in the pool room downstairs. I kept wanting to play hide and seek to see if he would do it again. He ended up having all these really beautiful girlfriends and I was always so jealous. My God, I couldn't take it. It would break my heart. When I was around 6 or 7, I had been at Graceland for the summer and my dad left on tour, so my mom's mom came and picked me up. We flew to New Jersey together to visit with her and my grandfather and my mom's 5 other siblings in Mount Holly. I never had a connection to my grandmother. One time, I was in the bathtub, and she knelt over to rinse me, and her cleavage was showing, and there was this giant dark mole on her chest. I looked at it and screamed bloody murder. Don't you pick me up with that thing you've got right there. I'd spent the summer with my father, where there had been no rules, so I needed to be de-braticized, but I wasn't having it. My mom's parents were very much of the mindset that I was nothing special, that I wouldn't be treated as anything special, that I was just like the rest of the family. The change was so confusing that I would often scream my head off. I remember screaming so loud for a good hour that my mom's younger brothers were all laughing at me. My mom had my grandmother's chilly disposition, which she got from her mother, my great-grandmother. At some point, I had a little cameo, a compact, a perfume thing that I loved. One day I couldn't find it, and I was so upset, crying, and everyone was trying to help me find it. Then I remember being in the car and looking down at my grandmother's purse. There it was. I said, "What's that?" She said, "You didn't see anything. It's nothing," and moved her purse away. I thought, "Oh my God, the bitch stole it from me." I know that I acted like a princess sometimes, but it's strange because I was, am, filled with self-doubt. It was all very confusing. Looking back, there was really only one thing I was sure of, that I was loved by my dad. We had my 9th birthday party in the Lisa Marie, my dad's plane. My dad was in the back in his bedroom, and he came out to join everybody standing around singing happy birthday. Charlie Hodge, his sort of sidekick on stage, came over to me, emptied his pockets out onto the table, and said, "Take whatever you want." He didn't have a present, so I was just grabbing the money. At that point, my dad was dating Ginger Alden. He'd had a bunch of different girlfriends, and I liked most of them. There was Sheila Kahn and Linda Thompson, who I loved. I could tell Linda really cared about me and my dad. When they broke up, he didn't tell me, and I ran up to give his girlfriend a hug, thinking it was Linda, but it turned out to be Ginger. I didn't mind Ginger, but I didn't like her. Nobody did. She was always very sweet to me, which was an obvious move unless you were an idiot, but I didn't like that she would upset him. I used to eavesdrop on their phone calls. He had one of those old-school phones where the line would light up and you could pick up on another receiver. Those conversations would make me absolutely nuts. She wasn't there for him. I could tell that she didn't love him at all. One time, he got in a fight with her, and I remember the sound of his Stutz, his favorite car, as it screeched away, because I knew they had been fighting when I heard him take off at high speed out of the gate. I was worried. I remember him asking me, "Have you seen Ginger? She around? Where is she?" "I don't know where she is," I said. She was driving him crazy, playing him hard. She would be there for him 1 minute and then gone. One day, I went with her to go visit her family. I didn't tell him I was going, but I told other people, and she wanted to take me, so I thought it was okay. When I got back, he was mad, and that wrecked me. That whole relationship was so tumultuous.
My mom learned from these experiences to put her children before her partners. Anytime she got a new partner, she'd bring us into the kitchen and say, "Guys, this is insert name." And she'd smile and watch as an uncomfortable exchange happened. But she always wanted to see our read on the new boyfriend. She trusted our instincts. Later, she'd say, "What did you think? Did you like him?" If we said no, he'd be gone. If he said one wrong thing to us, she would put him in his place.
Later that year, at the end of another amazing summer at Graceland, my dad was once again getting ready to go on tour. There were all those big tour cases lined up by the front door for loading. He was leaving the next day, and I was going back to California to start school. I was really depressed about leaving. I didn't want to go. My dad had built a giant racquetball center, and my friends and I had been hanging out there, playing around late at night. Really late, well after midnight. I was coming in through the back door just as my dad was coming out, and I ran into him. He said, "Go to bed." And I said, "Okay." I gave him a hug and a kiss, and we both said, "I love you." Then I headed upstairs and went to sleep. I woke up in a jolt in the early afternoon, and I sensed panic. I thought, something's not right. It felt like a different type of energy. It wasn't unusual for me to be woken up by a commotion. One night, I had been woken by drilling and pounding and singing and all kinds of stuff going on. My dad had wanted his organ to be brought upstairs so he could play and sing gospel in his room, but it wouldn't fit through his doors, so they had to do all this construction to get it in. I found Joe Esposito and said, "What's happening with my dad? Where is he?" "Your daddy's sick," Joe said. "What does that mean?" I said, and started running into his bathroom, which was absolutely enormous. So big, it had a wash bin just for his hair. The shower was gigantic too, a walk-in, and it kind of wrapped around. There was also a huge closet with a bed in it for somebody who wanted to take a nap, I guess. It had two entrances, one connected to my room. I ran across the bathroom, and there he was. Just as I was getting my eyes set on my dad on the ground, I tried to run to him, but somebody grabbed me and pulled me back. They were standing over him, moving him around and trying to work on him. I was screaming bloody murder. I knew it was not good. Then I got taken out of the room. There were so many times that I found him down on the floor or unable to control his body very well. It was the barbiturates. They held me and took me downstairs. A stretcher went upstairs. I was in the dining room. The front door was wide open. They brought the stretcher down the steps right past me. I didn't see his face, but I saw his head. I saw his body. I saw his pajamas, and I saw his socks at the bottom of the gurney. I broke free from whoever was holding me, and I ran toward the stretcher. Someone pulled me back. They had to keep working on him. It was lightning quick. He wasn't pronounced dead yet. They took him out, and I started screaming that I wanted him, that I needed him, and I started kicking and punching whoever was holding me back, trying to get away from them, but they wouldn't let me go. The front door shut. To be fair, if I had gotten to him, I would have seen his face, which was distorted, and that would have traumatized me more. Then we just had to wait. Over and over, I said, "Is he going to be okay? Is he going to be okay? Is he going to be okay?" Someone said, "We're just waiting for the hospital to call us to tell us." I grabbed my friend Amber, she was Ginger's niece, and we went upstairs to my room. I lit up a cigarette while we were waiting, spraying Windex in the air, hoping nobody would smell it. I remember Ginger had somehow had enough time to do her hair and her makeup. She was dressed to the nines. It had been about an hour when I heard my grandfather wailing. Wailing. That noise. I'll never get past that sound of him wailing. I couldn't work out what he was saying, so I went downstairs. As I got closer, I could hear, "Oh, oh, he's gone. He's gone." Everyone was in the room. My grandfather, Ginger, Aunt Delta, my great-grandmother, everyone. Everyone but my dad. "Who's gone?" I said. "Your daddy's gone. He's gone. My son is gone," my grandfather said. I was infuriated. I turned bright red, turned around, and I started to run. Ginger tried to grab the back of my shirt to hold me there, but I just fucking ran. I don't even know where I ran. I think I ran upstairs back to my room again and locked the door. I don't remember what I did after that. I just didn't know what to do. Anger, extreme anger, was my first response. The grief came later. I don't really know why, except that I was angry at the universe that this could happen. I went out on my golf cart toward one of the trailers in the back. We were watching the news, and then it hit me hard. My life, as I knew it, was completely over. It's your greatest childhood fear. When you love someone, you don't want to lose them. It's fucking terror, and it tortures you. Most kids have that worry. Whenever I told my dad I was scared he was going to die, he'd say, "I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere." But he did. Later, I was walking down the steps in the house and looked at the tour cases. It seemed like he was going to come down the stairs at any moment, and they were going to go on tour. Then I remember thinking, am I even going to be able to come back to Memphis? That afternoon, once they took him away, and this is something I've been upset about my whole life, it turned into a free-for-all. Everybody went to town. Everything was swiped, wiped clean, jewelry, artifacts, personal items, before he was even pronounced dead. You can still find things from that day coming up at auction. I heard my mother was coming for me. That was the worst. It felt like an invasion. Graceland was my place with my dad, and I didn't want her there. She was going to wreck the whole vibe. I had my friends. I had people around. Not only was she coming to take me home, which I didn't like, she was also coming to attend the funeral. Then I had another thought about not being able to come back here anymore. My grandfather was still alive, so I would have an excuse to come. But would she let me? She finally showed up, and I was on a golf cart with a friend or two. I remember her standing in the doorway at the front steps of Graceland and calling my name, trying to wave me down. I just waved back and kept going. She yelled at me, "How can you be on a golf cart right now?" I wouldn't give her any attention, though. I was so upset. I didn't understand at all why I got yelled at, but in retrospect, I can understand that she was probably thinking about the fans on the street. They could see me, and she probably thought it would be bad publicity to have me driving around in a golf cart playing with my friends after my dad just passed away, because the whole world had stopped. The viewing was scheduled to be a public event. My dad was brought to the house. They kept him in the living room, the room before the piano room on the right when you walk in the front door. I felt so happy because he was there. I felt lucky. I sat on the steps that go upstairs with a couple of my friends and watched endless seas of people going through the line and fainting and screaming and crying, grieving so hard. I don't know if anybody saw me. Maybe they did, but they were too busy looking at him. For countless hours, I sat and watched. Ambulances were outside taking people away every hour, people fainting. It felt like the whole country was there. You couldn't even see the streets anymore. There were so many people. I was so busy looking at everyone else's grief that I couldn't actually have mine yet. I was trying to grieve my dad, but at the same time, I understood that he was Elvis Presley. I understood his persona and that being Elvis was what he loved doing the most. Watching other people grieve my father made me not grieve in public. I just didn't. I couldn't. I don't remember how long the viewing went on, but there was so much drama. I held it all in. I would think, wow, look at that person. They're totally losing their shit. Then I would go grieve in my room where nobody could see me or at night before I'd go to sleep. I didn't know what to do with my grief. I would do stuff that would distract me, which would work for a little while, but if I had a minute, I would lose it. I went down to where he was lying in the casket just to be with him, to touch his face and hold his hand to talk to him. I asked him, "Why is this happening? Why are you doing this?" I knew that soon he wasn't going to be here anymore. I don't remember much after that. I was 9. It was all so fucking beyond me. It'll hit me still. On and off it comes. There have been nights as an adult when I would just get drunk and listen to his music and sit there and cry. The grief still comes. It's still just there. After my dad died, my world totally changed. Beyond my grandparents, I stayed in touch with Patsy and one or two people from the Memphis Mafia like Jerry Schilling. The rest kind of faded away. My mom stayed in Memphis until everything was finalized. And in October, my dad was moved from Forest Hill Cemetery to the backyard of Graceland next to his mother. That was the first time I really felt the loss. Obviously, from my dad passing away, but more than anything, I felt I was stuck with this woman. It was a 1-2 punch. He's dead, and now I'm stuck with her. My mom took me to Europe with her sister. Rome, France, and London. She tried to keep me really busy. They took me to Buckingham Palace. The press was going crazy. They kept finding us wherever we were. But at the palace, it was a quiet day. I watched the changing of the guard. I was annoyed. I thought, what are we doing out here? Why aren't we going in? Why are we just standing out here trying to get in when people can just come into Graceland? I didn't understand it. One night in France, I told my mom I was a reincarnated Marie Antoinette and that I had to go to Versailles. So she took me there, and I was walking around saying, yep, I recognize this, I recognize that. Before Europe, I had been sent off for 6 weeks to Rancho Oso, a summer camp in the mountains north of Santa Barbara. At camp, there was a horse I loved, and I rode a lot. That was healing. Then I'd be at the swimming pool having fun with all these kids and then instantly not feel right. I would get distracted for a minute and then go, oh my God, my dad died. Once I was lying in the sun and an Elvis song came on the radio and I just lay there crying for an hour. Most of those kids didn't know who I was and I didn't really care to say who I was. But then some of them started bragging to me that they'd been to Elvis Presley's funeral in Memphis. I saw his dead body, someone said. No, you didn't, I said. Yeah, we were there. I'm his daughter, I said. You weren't there. I was there. I know. After camp, my mom wanted me in a good school. So she put me in a ritzy one in Los Angeles. Everyone had a famous father and mother, and I wasn't into that at all. Then my mom got a French boyfriend and became obsessed with being French. So she put me in a French school and made me do fucking French lessons. I wanted my other life back. I always wanted to go to Memphis. I wanted to make sure I could go to Memphis, and that's what she used sometimes to threaten me. You're not going to be able to go to Memphis if you don't blah, blah, blah. And that would really upset me, but I would do whatever I needed to do. She knew it meant everything to me. I kept my watch on Memphis time. She did allow me to go every Christmas, Easter, and summertime. I'd stay with Patsy, who was a mother figure to me, and I would hang out with her and her kids. It meant so much to be part of that family. Every Sunday was cleaning day, and we'd watch movies, eat biscuits and gravy, biscuits and sausage, drink giant bottles of Pepsi, and go to the video store or go to Graceland for the night. My aunt still lived there for several years after my dad died. I would go and sleep over there while she was still alive. The kitchen wasn't open yet to the public. I'd stay in the room right off of it. Upstairs was locked. I could go up there, but I had to come back down. I don't know why. Maybe because his room was there. I think there were a lot of conversations going on about what to do with the upstairs to keep it preserved, but Vernon and my mom decided I wasn't allowed back into my room. Vernon died in 1979, and then a year later, my great-grandmother died. I remember a car pulling up at school both times. It became a thing that a car would just randomly show up. I got used to it. I started to think, there's the car. Who is it now? I had no emotional connection to my grandfather whatsoever. He was a very stern sort of presence. I never got past that with him. I remember my friend and I messing with my grandfather's face in his coffin when we were in there alone. That's not something I want to say lightly because I know it's truly horrific. There were stitches on him. I didn't understand why then, but I guess they had to open him up and let the body drain. I was becoming numb to everything. Just another funeral, another loss. Memphis was becoming a place just to go back to for funerals. Enough trauma had happened that it wasn't even affecting me anymore. Everyone was kind of expecting me to be upset, but nothing was fazing me. There was just so much trauma.
Sometimes I'd walk into my mom's bedroom and find her sitting on the floor alone, drunk, listening to her father's music, crying. But she'd never talk about it or listen to his music sober. It's difficult to go about your day without hearing an Elvis song out in the world. But I still remember the first time my mom put Elvis on in the car. There were, of course, times his songs would come on in a cafe or she'd stumble onto them while switching the radio channel, and when this happened, I would catch her leaving it on. But this particular day, when my sisters were little, we were all driving somewhere and I realized that this was the first time she chose to put his music on, tuning to Elvis radio on Sirius as she drove. She told my sisters, "This is your grandfather." I remember thinking it was so strange, but also very sweet. I was 22. I don't think she ever processed the loss. I think she started to the last year she was alive. She only began using terms like trauma as late as 2021, but I certainly knew she was heartbroken my whole life. I remember when I was little feeling angry at Elvis for leaving my mother and for causing all this pain. Whenever I would hear Elvis's voice, I would feel my mother's anguish, feel the loss of him.
My grandfather had known that I'd had a crush on Rory Miller. After Vernon died, I found out the Millers were moving to Colorado. I was supposed to meet and hang out with Rory before they left. In fact, I'd arranged to spend the whole day with him. Patsy knew it, and last minute, I got a phone call. "Your mom wants you to fly home to LA today." Patsy had told my mom, and my mom was not having it. I was devastated. Rory took me to the airport. That was the first time I remember having actual, real, specific hatred toward my mother. I saw Rory when I was on tour many years later. I had dinner with him and his wife and Patsy. Rory said, "Your father pulled me aside and told me, 'You better not do anything or I'll fucking kill you.'" My dad didn't use the F word that loosely, so the message was received loud and clear. Rory said he promised my dad he would never do anything with me romantically, and he promised, too, that he wouldn't ever tell me about the conversation. "But I think I can probably say it safely now," Rory said. My mother sent me away a lot, but I will say that she was really good at birthdays. One year, I remember going to see Queen at the Forum. I'd heard that Freddie Mercury was a huge fan of my dad, so I brought him one of my dad's scarves. I watched the show, and then I went backstage and met Freddie, who was very sweet, very humble, and very moved by the gift. When I turned 10 years old, my mom met John Travolta and arranged for him to meet me for that birthday. He was having a hot moment with Welcome Back, Kotter. He talked to her about Scientology, and a few days later, she joined. I was in the car with her, and she was describing it to me, saying that it can help you become really powerful. I was always obsessed with Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I wanted to have superpowers. Okay, I thought, that's really cool. I want to do that. So now we were members of the Church of Scientology. My mom would drop me off after school at their building in Hollywood. I felt like she was dumping me there so they could handle me and she didn't have to. Scientology actually helped. It gave me someplace to go and somewhere I could be introspective, somewhere to talk about what had happened and some way to deal with it. I took to it quickly and I really liked it. I got the idea that we weren't just our brains, we weren't just our bodies, we weren't just our emotions. We had those things, but that wasn't all that we were. We were spirits. I would ask myself, why are we here? Why am I here? What's the point of everything? At that point, the church felt radical in an exciting way. It didn't feel like an organized religion, really. It attracted cool, unusual, artistic people. It became my tribe. At the French school my mom sent me to, all the kids seemed to be celebrity spawns. Tony Curtis's daughters went there, Peter Sellers' daughter, Vidal Sassoon's daughter, Katya. Katya was in my class, and I was obsessed with her because her mother would buy her anything. She always had the newest stuff, like a pair of sandals with heels, which I then had to have. At one point, she brought in liquid paper, and I had to have that, too. My mom was annoyed about it. I remember I wanted to go spend the night at Katya's house. All my friends had gotten to stay over, and she had an elevator in her house. I was so excited to go, but my mom wouldn't let me. She thought Katya was spoiled and didn't want me to be around that. My mom would later become friends with Vidal and Beverly Sassoon, and sadly, Katya died of a drug overdose when she was 33. I can see that my mom had been strong in a good way. More than anything, she was worried about me being spoiled. I don't think I was. I think that I could be absent-minded about things, but I don't think I was deliberately spoiled. I know my dad spoiled me, but my mom did the opposite. My mom was very strict, in fact. She was never a friend, someone I could talk to. I felt like I was her trophy. She wanted a cotillion for me. I didn't even know what that was, but she always wanted one. She wanted me to go to finishing school. I felt like she should have gotten a different daughter. It was about how things looked. The way things appeared seemed more important than feelings. My mom would never allow herself to lose control. Everything was all in its place. My mom was gone a lot. She was on some island eating something she caught out of the ocean, or she was off in some other foreign land, or she was on another adventure with another man. So I started having more nannies and more chefs. She hired lots of people, and I became close with many of them. I felt safest when my aunt and uncle, Michelle and Gary, lived in our house with us. At the time, we had a long hallway. My room was near the end of it, and Michelle and Gary's room was all the way at the other end. That hallway would terrify me at night, but when they were there, I felt better. Michelle and Gary were the only two I could really talk to. When my mom was away, I could have a friend over. That was always my saving grace. But I didn't have an easy time making friends. I still don't. Maybe they thought I was a spoiled brat when, in fact, I was just terrified. There I was in some ritzy, posh school with all these celebrity kids and everyone speaking French and traveling the world and studying like crazy because they want to be the best. I just wasn't into any of that. I was terribly insecure, frightened, scared, you name it. People wouldn't make friends with me, or they'd get competitive. Whose parents were richer? Who had the bigger house? That still happens. And people think that I'm a bitch because, unfortunately, I have my mom's chili thing. I was falling behind in every subject. I would lock myself in my room and listen to my records. Music, always, always, always. Twice a year after he died, I'd dream about my father. The dreams were so real that I would cry when I'd wake up because it felt like I was with him and I hadn't wanted it to end. I'd try so hard to get back to sleep, to be with him again. I don't really believe they were dreams. I believe they were visitations. I know a lot of people will disagree with me and think that's nonsense. You might have these kinds of dreams too and blow them off and say they're just dreams. That's fine. But I believe that people we love from our past can visit us. And my dad would do that regularly. In the dreams, he and I would be together in my room. I'm in my hamburger bed and he's in the chair. We're close and connected, talking. Suddenly, I get panicked and say, "Wait, you have to stop this, Daddy. You have to wait. You're going to OD. You're going to have a heart attack, Daddy. You're going to die. It's going to happen." And in the dream, my dad looks at me so calmly, so knowingly, smiles and says, "Darling, it's already happened." And then I'd wake up. The dreams only stopped in 1992 when my son was born.
It was so, so hard hitting. It was so shocking. It was so upsetting. You can tell if something really terrible had just happened. The loss that has come upon all of us, like, united. I didn't realize that. I was having my own trying to grieve my father, but yet I understood Elvis Presley at the same time. I had to sort of deal with mine over a lot of time. It was like a slow burn. It's still there if I go there. I don't necessarily cry, but I still feel all of the energy that's there. It's still there.